from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Writer Ann Patchett knew two things early on in life, that relationships, marriage, looked fleeting, and that she, even as a girl, wanted to write, to be a writer, a novelist. But how to get there? There was plenty of nonfiction along the way. She's sharing it now with some thoughts on love, dogs, opera, and yes, the writing life. This hour, On Point writer Ann Patchett. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Do you know Ann Patchett's novels? Do you see how she sees art and life, love? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Nashville, Tennessee, is writer and bookstore owner Ann Patchett. Her novel Bel Canto, about opera and terrorism, won her the Pen Faulkner Award and was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award. Her latest, State of Wonder, took us to rainforests and pharmaceutical hunters. Her new collection of essays, new and old, is called This is the Story of a Happy Marriage. You can read an excerpt at our website. Ann Patchett, welcome to On Point. Wonderful to have you here.
I'm so glad to be here.
There's so much that's fun in here. It goes back a long time over a lot of publications. I'm looking down your list here, The Atlantic and Gourmet and Grunt and Harper's and New York Times, Outside, South Carolina Review, Vogue, Wall Street Journal. You've published all over the place, madam.
Oh, yes, but I left out the scary stuff. I left out Mercedes-Benz magazine and Bridal Guide and 17. I could do about 15 more volumes of things you really don't want to read.
17 above all. You're not including it here, but you make no bones about writing for 17 magazine, being sort of absolutely the just do it, rung upon rung ladder that got you really in the biz.
I did. I published my first short story at 17 Magazine, I think when I was 21, and I wrote nonfiction for them until I was 30, and then I quit. I had completely strip-mined my childhood and teenage years. I had nothing else to go back on, but boy, did I learn a lot in the trenches at 17.
I want to look at how that worked and a whole lot more, but the title of this collection is so intriguing. Maybe we should go there right off the bat. This is the story of a happy marriage. Which is kind of funny when we get in here and read. I forget how many. You lived in like a dozen, what had moved 15 times before the time you went to college. Stability in married life was not exactly the bedrock of your youth. What about you and love and the married life? What are you telling us here, Ann?
You know, I had given the book, an early copy of the book, to a friend of mine, and he said his wife picked it up and looked at it and said about the title, is this supposed to be ironic? and it actually isn't. I actually am really happily married, and it seems just jaw-dropping to me every day that this has worked out, that there was some sort of learning curve. Divorce in my family goes back four generations. Everyone, as far as the eye can see, in every direction, has gotten divorced. Marriage has just been something that my particular tribe has been really bad at. And yet, you know, miraculously, I am happily married after a lot of work in a long time.
Tell us a little about that story. I mean, you had one early and it failed that made you doubly, triply, quadruply wary. And then the man to whom this volume is devoted, Carl, comes along, and you're with him for 11 years, but do not marry until you think he's going to die.
Right. Right. Isn't that a good way of doing it?
Okay, whatever.
I got divorced when I was 25, mm-hmm. and I made one of those kind of, I had my Scarlett O'Hara in the field moment with the radishes, as God is my witness. If I get out of this, I will never, never go back in.
You seem to mean it. It took you a long time.
I thought I'd really beat the system. And then I met Carl when I was 30. And he was great, and I loved him. And after a couple of years, I bought a little house down the street from his. And I said, this is perfect. We don't have to do it the way everybody else does it. I will stay with you forever. I don't want to live with you. I don't want to marry you. This way, if we don't get into the system, we can never be thrown out of the system. I thought that I had really got it licked. And then when I was 41... Carl got sick. He had a cardiomyopathy. Yeah. He went up to the Mayo Clinic. It looked very bad. Mm. They were talking about a spot on the heart transplant list. Carl's a doctor, so, you know, I take him seriously.
Right.
I fly up to Mayo in a snowstorm. It's very dramatic. And we're in the airport. Carl, I should say, has wanted to get married for these 11 years.
Yes, we noticed.
and so I said, boy, you know, I guess when I get home, I'll sell my house and we'll get married. And because I was thinking, God forbid something happens. I can't do anything as your girlfriend. Like, I can't unplug the ventilator. This is what I'm thinking about going into marriage.
This is what it took. Here's the leverage.
That's right.
Can't unplug the ventilator. How romantic.
I really love you, and I want to be your widow. That's kind of what I was thinking. But, you know, we came home. I put my house on the market, and it sold in 4 hours. I literally live three blocks away, so I just moved over my stuff in the car. We got a marriage license, which in the state of Tennessee is good for 30 days. We have a friend who's a priest. He came by on his way to a Kentucky Derby party. We can never remember when we actually got married, except we got married on Derby Day. So that's what we always celebrate. Whenever we see in the newspaper on a Sunday morning that it's the Kentucky
thundering
Derby,
horses, right?
We turn around and go, oh, happy anniversary. He signed the paper. We mailed it in. And then I, 3 or 4 months later, Carl was fine.
Ann Patchett writes in her collection called This is the Story of a Happy Marriage, I can tell you how I came to have a happy marriage, but I'm not sure my results can be reproduced. Wait until everyone you know gets divorced. Then get divorced yourself. Find a divorced man. Date him for 11 years. Wait until you think his situation is terminal and then marry him. It will not be terminal. Ann Patchett joins us from Nashville, and Ann, we have callers for you already. Rod in Nashville, you're on with Ann Patchett. Thanks for calling, Rod.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
And hi, Ann.
Hi.
Yes, I am calling from Nashville. And that is my question, Ann. And this probably, you've probably heard it over and over. Why do we fall in and out of love? Because I've been down that same road and have a family of not good marriages and divorces. But yet, I keep finding myself falling in and out of love. And I'll hang up and listen. If you know the secret to that, I would
know. The timeless question. Thank you, Rod, Ann.
Everything in me wants to say, why do birds sing right. so gay and lovers await the break of day?
Why do?
You know, let's just sing through
the
show,
No, I don't know. The question's already there. What's the answer?
The question's a good one. We are mammals, and mammals seek other mammals. And I really think at the end of the day, that's what it is. We're sort of driven to pair up. It's an arc mentality. And there have been many times in my life that I have said, I am swearing this off. It's really funny. Elizabeth Gilbert was here 2 days ago. Mm-hmm. She was on book tour, and she's a friend of mine. And we were having breakfast. She's got her fabulous new book, Signature of All Things, is out. And we were having breakfast, and she looked at me and she said, you know, we both have husbands who are older. If anything, God forbid, were to happen, would you ever date again? And I said, I would shave my head, I would get a rice bowl, and I would take up a life of contemplative silence. And she said, me too. So, there is this, even now, happy, secure, this terrible fear of, I hear people talk about dating, and I think I would jump off a bridge before I would date again.
But Rod says, why do we go in and out, is Rod's question. One of the answers you give about why marriage is so hard, if that's part of that dynamic, is so simple. You say it's just that we grow up in different houses. We grow up in different families. So we start with different presumptions and assumptions about how things will work.
And so often it's the case that neither one of us is right. Neither one of us is wrong. We just come from different tribes. You know, even if we come from the same city, it's so hard to get our habits aligned. And there's a way in which I think if you can find someone who has a basic similar moral code and some very basic habits, you know, if you go to bed at 9 o'clock at night, don't marry somebody who goes to bed at 3 o'clock in the morning, because those are really the things that will kill you in the end. But it's an enormous amount of work to stick it out and to make love into that deeper thing that really sustains us. And I think that that's sort of the theme that runs throughout the book. You think it's really romantic at first, no matter what it is, if it's art, if it's business, if it's your job. And I'm going to be 50 next month. And at this point in my life, I just think the things that really count are work And we're a culture that loves the lottery. You know, we think we're going to find true love. We're going to win $20 million. A lightning bolt is going to come down and change our life. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's like that if you stick it out for a long time.
I am right with you there. Yes, with luck, if you find yourself plugged in the right place in the right way, there's nothing like the work to carry you through. In love, if it's all about growing up in different households, that different families, different tribes, what great fodder for your work. What great fodder for a novelist. I mean, that's just endless.
That's true. If it worked out for all of us, what would I have to write about?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with celebrated novelist Ann Patchett about love, truth maybe, and the writing life. She joins us today from Nashville, author of The Patron Saint of Lies, way back in 92, her first novel, and then right on through Bel Canto, State of Wonder, Run, The Magician's Assistant, Taft. Lots of nonfiction along the way as well. She's put that together in a new volume, This is the Story of a Happy Marriage. And yes, it has plenty on relationships and love, and it has a lot about the writing life. She writes right at the beginning, and Patchett writes, the tricky thing about being a writer or about being any kind of artist is that in addition to making art, you also have to make a living. My short stories and novels have always filled my life with meaning, she writes, but at least in the first decade of my career, they were no more capable of supporting me than my dog was. But part of what I love about both novels and dogs is that they are so beautifully oblivious to economic concerns. It isn't their responsibility to figure out where the rent is coming from. Ann Patchett, and This is the Story of a Happy Marriage. It's funny, Ann, you write about your Catholic school upbringing, your Catholic education, somehow being important to getting you off on the right foot as a writer because you say it prepared you. It stressed the importance of modesty and humility, not movie deals, royalty checks, or foreign rights.
Yeah, those 12 years in Catholic girls' school, which I griped about a lot while I was living them, actually have served me well in all sorts of ways. And one was this idea that we all had a calling. That was, the nuns were selling that a lot. Everybody had something in the great grand design of the world that they were supposed to do. And the two things that they really put out was we could be wives or we could be mothers. And I felt very clearly from an early age that my calling was that I wanted to be a writer. And when you think about it, there I was, a girl who was surrounded by these nuns who were professional women who had decided to, you know, give their whole life over to their career, as it were. They didn't get married. They didn't have children. They went to work every day. And they were great role models for me.
Role models because you weren't focused on the money right off the bat, so you were ready just to run in, pick up your calling, and do it.
That's right, actually. Vow of poverty. We talked a lot about the vow of poverty back then. And I thought, well, if you really love something, you're willing to be poor. These nuns really loved God, and they had taken a vow of poverty. And I really loved writing, and I just assumed that writing meant you were going to be poor. I had a very La Boheme view of what it would mean to be a novelist. I would live in a garret in Paris and have a little candle stub. I really believed that when I was a kid, and I didn't know any novelists. They weren't just out walking around. But again, I saw the enactment of poverty, and they looked very peaceful and happy, those nuns. They didn't seem to be pining for anything. And that was a great, great lesson. The fact that when I was young, I never had any debt, and I lived a really small, cheap life because I didn't ever want to be stressed out about money. I didn't ever want to be thinking, oh, you know, I can't write this book because I have to get a job to make more money because what I really want is a house or health insurance or children or any of those things that wind up being so expensive later
on. And yet you are tuned to economics, and it's part of what took you to 17 Magazine because they would publish you again and again and again, especially if you wrote nonfiction. You're not including that in this collection because, you know, that's about what it is to be 16 or 17. But it was the discipline, the sort of endless responding to editors' feedback that you value out of that?
Well, it just really made me tough. People come up to me all the time, especially when I was writing for Gourmet magazine, and they were sending me to Italy and sending me off on sailboat trips in the Caribbean. And people would say, how do I get those gigs? How can I get those jobs?
How great. How beautiful.
And I would say, oh, I can tell you exactly what worked for me. Go do freelance at 17 for 9 years, and then you can go to Italy and have somebody else pay for it. When I started asking for freelance assignments, again, I had sold them a story, but you could only really sell them one story a year because they only published one a month. They weren't going to run the same fiction writer over and over again. But they published nonfiction writers in every issue, the same person.
Sure.
So I could see that's where the tiny bit of money was going to be coming from. And I would write 6-7 pieces and send them in, and they would say no. And then I would write 6 or 7 more, and they would say, well, maybe this one. And they would have me rewrite that piece 6 or 7 times. And every single person who worked at the magazine, the janitorial staff, the 16-year-old interns, they would all get a crack at my piece writing in the margins. Well, this didn't happen to me when I was 16, you know. And then I would go back and just do it over and over and over again. And I think that probably genetically I am a pretty unsentimental person, but that really sharpened my skills in being unsentimental. I don't have feelings. People are always saying to me, oh, is this going to hurt your feelings? Is this bad review going to hurt your feelings? And I think, I don't have any feelings. I worked at 17 for 9 years. I don't have any feelings.
You're right. The conversations I had so often with magazine editors were now internalized. This is when you were now writing novels. You said, You hear this. This is in italics here. The editor asking, did I think that this was a beautiful scene that I'd written? Yes, I did. Did it further the cause of the novel? No, not really. Could I then delete it? It was already gone. Talk about the impact on craft of that sort of churn it out nonfiction, heavily edited early on. When we sit down and read State of Wonder or Bel Canto, what's on the page that in craft terms that comes out of that time?
I have an incredible awareness of other people's time, and I think that I have more and more of it as I get older, and of my own time. Mm. And that's the message from magazine writing. You know, you've got this much space, you've got 2,000 words, that costs money. Those 2,000 words have to be covered by a certain number of ads, and if an ad is dropped, then your 2,000 words goes down to 1,200 words.
Make it so.
Exactly. Magazine readers just have a little bit of time. And I really started to realize that everyone has just a little bit of time, and these days especially. It's not necessarily that something has to always be short, but I do think that fiction needs, for me, to get to the point. And I can think of a lot of wonderful writers whose names I will not mention on the radio who just write such gorgeous scenes, fabulous language, and I get to the end of that 600-page book and think, wow, that could really have been a 250-page book. Because a lot of the writing just feels like it's there because they can do it. I know you can do it, but tell me a story. And I think that in my novels, I try very much to get to the point. I like the idea of the reader getting to the end of the chapter and thinking, when I get to the end of chapter 11, I am turning the light out and going to sleep, but I'm going to make something so compelling at the end of chapter 11 that they are going to begrudgingly go on to chapter 12. And I think that really came out of magazine writing. How do you hook people? How do you keep their interest? And you can be very literary and still care about the reader's time and their interests.
Tell me a story. Grace Paley and Russell Banks have their roles here. We'll come to them. We're talking about love and the writing life with Anne Patchett. Patchett, her collection of nonfiction is This Is the Story of a Happy Marriage. A couple of strands here. Anne joins us from Nashville. We've got the callers for you. Beth in Wayland, Massachusetts. You're on with Anne Patchett, Beth.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Anne. It's such an honor to talk to you. You're my absolute favorite author, and I had the great pleasure that I have two daughters in their 20s who I introduced to your writing, and you're also their favorite author.
Hey, thanks. It's a family thing. Thank you.
It is a family thing, and it's such an honor to talk to you. I just wanted to mention a couple of things about your some of your books that I just love so much. First of all, my favorite of your books is Patron Saint of Liars, your first novel.
Hey, you and my mother-in-law.
I love the way it starts with the babbling brook, you know, the spring that breaks through the ground. It's such, it just kind of nails the book into a time period and sort of all eternity and nature in such a beautiful way that holds through the whole novel. And the other scene that comes to mind for me is the great scene in your book Run, where the girl is running at Harvard Stadium. You know, everyone's watching her, and the sort of the incredible beauty of her running. I have a daughter who runs track, and that's her favorite scene in all of your books.
Nice.
Yeah, it really is. And I just want to say that we look forward to your books as they come out, and it's such a pleasure to read them, and we're looking forward to your next book also.
Beth,
thank you so much.
Thank you for your call, Beth. There you go. Boy, that's a novelist's dream. Have them lined up and ready for the next.
Just love. It's so
just
nice.
Love.
Thank you. Thank you for the love.
Beth, thank you for the love. We got more love calls here, maybe from a different angle. Dustin in Akron, Ohio. Dustin, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just would like to say, from a younger person's point of view, I believe that a lot of the marriages of people my age are doomed because of the older people and people that have been in marriages constantly talking about how horrible it is and how bad marriages is, you know, are, and, you know, the different stereotypes of what a marriage would be like. It puts it in the back of our subconscious like, oh, no, it's going to fail. It's going to fail constantly the whole time we're married before we even get married.
No, it's completely your responsibility. I don't buy that at all. I just think people can be negative. People chatter their negative thoughts. But when you're in a relationship with someone, it is, at the end of the day, it's the two of you and you're together and you're responsible for that. And you cleave to one another, hold on to one another. And that noise falls away. I really, really believe that. It's got to be the two of you.
But what about, I mean, take the generational sting there for a second. You know, you're sort of the tail end of Boomer. And part of the...
I feel it today.
Okay. Part of the rap has been that the Boomers, you know, were too casual about it. And it ended up being messy in 17 different ways. And now here's Dustin looking at it, and all he hears is the bad-mouthing of long-term relationship, and it feels like it sets up. I mean, you're right, and in the end, it's his to deal with. But what about the tone that's set here?
Was it better before? I don't think so. I got divorced when I was 25.
Yeah.
I've been down that road. I don't think it's because my head was full of other people's divorces. I think it's because I was miserable. And as much as I love my marriage and believe in marriage, I have to say, I also really believe in divorce. And I think that the good old days where people stuck it out no matter what and stayed married, I think people were probably really miserable a lot of the time. I think that if culturally we had had a little more freedom to get out of our marriages that were awful, you know, where people were smacking us around and, you know, we were having a crummy struggle of a life, I don't think that that's better. I think that every single marriage is its own unique snowflake, and I don't know. I'm grateful. I'm grateful that the people who need to get out culturally can get out now.
I mean, you go so far, you say you wish there was a sacrament for divorce, the eighth sacrament. You're right. Like communion, it is a slim white wafer on the tongue. Like confession, it is forgiveness. Forgiveness is important not so much because we've done wrong as because we feel we need to be forgiven. Family, friends, God, whoever loves us, forgives us, take us in again. They're thrilled by our life, our possibilities, our second chances. They weep with gladness that we did not have to die. I guess did not have to die to make that break and then forgive.
When I got married the first time, the priest said, is this a union that can only be dissolved by death? And I wasn't married yet, you know. I was in the pre-marriage classes, and I thought, is this a union that can only be dissolved by death, my death, his death? No, I frankly, I'd rather get divorced.
Let's have another sacrament
than
out
one
there.
Of us. Yeah. Right. Let me out.
Love and Writing with Ann Patchett. Uma Laney is calling from Dorchester, Massachusetts. Uma Laney, you're on the air with Ann. Thanks for calling.
Oh, hello. Hello, Ann. Hello.
Hi.
Oh, I'm so pleased to be able to talk to you. I have to admit that this is my first introduction to you, to hearing your work and hearing about your process. And as a poet myself, I am really moved by the way in which you talk about writing and your approach in terms of making sure that you don't waste people's time in terms of giving them what they need, you know, to turn the page and so forth.
Poets are really good at that.
We try. I'm really looking forward to reading some of your work, and I particularly like the fact that you're discussing and talking about love and marriage and divorce. I come from a family of divorce, and I myself am married, and I came to marriage sort of in a roundabout way, so it was really great to hear the story of how you got married, sort of in a non-conventional way, if you will.
You know, it's all woven together here, Umalini, and I appreciate your call. I mean, if we can just flip to Grace Paley, first of all, I can't believe that you studied short story writing with her, like the greatest of the great. No better short story writer, possibly no better person. She's one of those people who kind of lives on a cloud in my mind, and there you were with her sort of unruly hair and her endless activism. And you say that her big lesson to you was that writing must not be compartmentalized. Meaning what? Yeah.
Meaning that you can't just go into your office and close the door and write, and that is one person who's in that room, and then you come out and you're an entirely different person. Grace really believed the message that I got from Grace was that you are the same if you are being a wife, a mother, a friend, a writer, a political activist. The things you care about in one area of your life are the things that you care about in another area of your life. You can't be a jerk and then go in and sit down and think you're going to write really beautiful fiction. And that we're also responsible for more than just writing. You know, it's not enough to be a great writer. You really have to be a great person. And that was her lesson. That's what she was trying to teach us how to do. And in the times in my life that I've taught and I haven't done it, people always love to ask that question. Do you think writing can be taught? Yeah, sure. I can teach you how to write a better sentence. I can teach you how to do plot development. I can teach you how to, you know, shape a character. But I can't teach you how to have something to say. I can't make you a more interesting person. And that's what Grace really was trying to do with us. She was trying to teach us how to be moral souls and how to have something to say, how to have character ourselves instead of just worrying about how to write our characters.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with celebrated novelist Ann Patchett about love, truth, the writing life. Her novels, well, very well known. State of Wonder, Bel Canto, all the way back to the patron saint of liars. Now she's out with a collection of her nonfiction from over the years, published in all kinds of magazines all over the place. It is called This Is the Story of a Happy Marriage. She joins us from Nashville, where she's also a bookstore owner. In this day and age, we'll talk about that. And lots of comment for you online. Toy says, talking about love, says, marriage? How outdated. Transcend your biological roots. I'm 40, dated once, never married, such a messy affair. Living alone is enjoyable and doesn't mean you're lonely. You should get used to it as well, because remember, you die alone. there's Toy's message for you.
And you know, that was a lot of how I felt in those 11 years when I was happily dating Carl and saying, I don't want to get married. I don't want to conform. I don't think marriage is for everyone. I don't think that there is only one way to do it. But, you know, I'm enjoying it.
And this one, Holly writes, she says, I just finished reading Truth and Beauty last night. Your relationship with Lucy was so intense, much more intense than most marriages appear to be. Can you talk about the love between girlfriends?
Yeah. You know, there was, well, I should say, my friend Lucy Greeley, who was a great writer, we went to college together. We lived together in graduate school. She died when she was 39. She'd had cancer as a child, a lot of reconstructive surgery, hard life. And I can remember after I wrote Truth and Beauty, after she died, somebody asking me, what was that relationship like? What would sum up that relationship? And I said, it really is best captured by the marriage vows. You know, do you promise to honor this person in sickness and in health, in good times and in bad times, mm-hmm. for better or for worse, for as long as you both shall live? People will say, well, you know, it wasn't an equal relationship. You took care of her. She didn't take care of you. Well, guess what?
She
relationships
had big health
aren't
issues,
equal.
Of course. Mm-hmm.
She had huge health issues, a really tough life. But, you know, there are some people, if we're lucky, and not just our spouses, there are people in our life that we make a decision about, I will be with you no matter what. I will love you no matter what happens, and I will see you out of this life. Mm-hmm. And Lucy was absolutely one of those people, and I was so lucky to know her and to get to spend 17 years of my life in that friendship. You know, I had that sort of relationship with my grandmother who I took care of, yeah. and that's all in there.
No, I so understand that sentiment and that commitment. You write about in the book the furor that came out of that when the book Truth and Beauty was assigned to students at Clemson at the college in South Carolina. And there, this sort of shower of unease, at the least, that was poured on this book of friendship between two women.
Yes, Clemson chose the book as their incoming read for the freshman class. I didn't ask them. They invited me to come and do the convocation address. This is the kind of thing I do all the time. Mm-hmm. And a few weeks before I got there, there was a big public outcry saying that the book was pornography. It was, you know, forcing all of these terrible ideas on young people. It was so scandalous. And I went to South Carolina. My sister was living in South Carolina then, and she picked me up. And my favorite line from that whole experience is, my sister looked at me and she said, if it had been two guys who had seen each other through all of these hard times, mm-hmm. they would have called it Brian Song and named the football stadium after you. And I do think that there's something that makes some people, just a few people, uneasy about women having really close friendships.
Let's hear from another reader of Truth and Beauty, Carol in Boston. You're on with Ann Patchett.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Oh, I just wanted to thank Anne for all of her books. I love them all. I've read them all, more than once. And I did have a comment about Truth and Beauty, but actually you just answered everything I was thinking about your relationship with Lucy. And so you kind of already answered it. So I guess I could just, if I could just ask you about, I read the article about you in the New York Times book review yesterday, which I enjoyed, and your bookstore and your book recommendations. And now that you own your own bookstore, how that... I don't know, how do you see that as affecting your writing, if it will, at all?
Thanks, Carol. Anne?
You know, I'm kind of in the middle of it right now. It was really great to work on this book and have the bookstore because it was a book that was put together in short pieces. I have a novel that I want to start to write as soon as I get home from book tour, and today is day one of book tour, so that's a while out there. And I don't know how it's going to be. But I will say the bookstore has been nothing but a plus in my life. It's been such a joy to work with the people who work there, to be able to put books I love into people's hands, to bring in the fantastic writers. I'll tell you, in the last 10 days, we had Donna Tartt, Garrison Keillor, Pat Conroy, and Elizabeth Gilbert at the bookstore.
Wow.
And it's just a thrill and a joy. It definitely changes the dynamic of my private life and of my sort of quiet, withdrawn, I'm holing up to write a novel kind of life. Mm-hmm. But maybe this is just the new moment in my life. When I go to the grocery store now, everybody comes up to me and says, oh, thank you for the bookstore. We love the bookstore. I'm so much more involved in the community and in Nashville and in the community of readers and of writers and of doing my part to kind of save independent bookselling and help publishing. And those things are really important to me. This is my industry. So hopefully I can balance that with writing a novel. But for right now, this is really important.
Talk about the why of it. I mean, you began to go there right there. I mean, it's called Parnassus after the sort of Greek home of Mount Parnassus, literature, learning. But in this time of all times, I mean, you're not starting Amazon too. You're not selling Kindles. You're selling physical books in a place.
I'm so not selling Kindles.
Why? Why are you planting that flag now?
Well, Nashville had two 30,000-square-foot bookstores. We had a Borders mm-hmm. and we had Davis Kidd, which used to be our beloved locally owned and operated, but had been sold to a chain in Ohio. And both of those stores were profitable every month. That's a big rent, 30,000 square feet. Yeah. That's like a little Macy's department store.
Yeah.
And they both went under at a corporate level around the same time. So suddenly we didn't have a bookstore. We had a lot of great used bookstores, but frankly, I write new books. That doesn't do me a lot of good. I wanted to live in a city with a bookstore. Nobody else opened a bookstore. I met my partner, Karen Hayes, and we decided to throw in together and do this project. And it just makes sense, right? 60,000 square feet of retail space that's been profitable every month. We opened a store that was 3,000 square feet. You don't have to be a mathematician to crunch those numbers and say there are still a lot of people out there who want to go to a bookstore.
Yeah, I guess you went on with Stephen Colbert and he just made fun of you for, you know, hey, aren't you aware of what's happening in the world? You know, the digital.
That's his job.
Yes,
his job is to make fun of me.
Of course.
But it's going great because, you know, we still want this. I mean, and it's also a redemption tale. You know, when you have your local independent pharmacy and it gets swallowed up by Walgreens, you don't tend to get another one back. When you lose your local hardware store or your wine store, whatever it is you lose, the community doesn't get that back. So in Nashville, we lost our bookstore and then we got it back. And Nashvillians line up every day to come in and buy books at the bookstore because they want to be part of what we represent. We are a community center. We have story hour for your kids. We have a jazz workshop every month. We have all these amazing writers coming in. We have this incredibly smart staff. Cannot believe the people who work at that store. And you can come in and say, okay, I just read The Goldfinch, and I thought it was the best thing I've ever read. What should I read next? Well, you should read the novels of Edward St. Albans next, and we can put that together for you. It's a good feeling. It's all a plus.
Champion of the bookstore there in Nashville. Your last teacher, fiction teacher, in college was Russell Banks.
Yeah.
And he was he was tough with you, tough in a good way. Remind us what he told you.
I was a senior in college. I was a very successful fiction writer as far as being the person in the class who people thought, you know, oh, well, she writes really good stories. And I went into Russell's office one day for a conference, and he said, you're really talented, you're good, you have a lot of skill, you're never going to get any feedback in class that's going to teach you anything. But he said, you're facile, you're superficial, and you have to decide whether or not you want to write great television or great literature.
By which he meant something of heft or something of what? Just nice polish.
Right, exactly. You know, I was headed down the road of polish, and he thought that I was capable of more. And I think that there are a few magic moments in life when the right person tells you the truth, and most importantly, that you are at a moment in your life when you're able to hear it. And the second he said that, it was really like being hit by a bolt of lightning. If I wanted to do better work, the only person who could force me to do better work was me. And I left his office a changed person. And I love Russell. He has a great collection of short stories coming out because I'm always trying to sell books month.
Did you know, though, intuitively or on consideration, what he meant?
I knew exactly, right at the second.
So up to that moment, you'd known you were sort of skating.
Did
you know how to deliver the beef, the extra, the heft, the weight, the depth?
Or he just turned the lights on. Yeah. I didn't think, oh, I'm just being clever.
Mm-hmm.
But as soon as he said it, you know, it's kind of like you put on an outfit, you think you look okay, and somebody says, man, that's really clashing. And then the second you hear it, you think, oh, yes, you're right. Of course, I see it now. And it wasn't like I walked out of there thinking, well, from now on, I'm going to have an abducted child in every story I write to give it more emotional heft. It was just I'm going to have to push myself harder. I'm going to have to work harder.
You went on to Iowa to the writing program, the Writer's Workshop there, famous, of course.
Yeah.
Now, with Russell Banks, it's easy to know you should listen to Russell Banks. But you said in Iowa, you learned how to tune your ear to the usefulness or uselessness of other people's opinions. You have to know whom to listen to and whom to ignore where your work is concerned. Well, give us that formula. How do you decide? How do you know?
You know, that's really developing your ear. It's almost like learning pitch. Because sometimes you can go into a class and there are 15 people there and 14 people will say, your story is great. And one person will say, no, actually, it's not so great. You know, this is the problem. And you know, just like I heard Russell, you just know when someone is telling you the truth about your own work. And I know from having been a teacher and teaching creative writing classes, what so often happens is that the worse a story is, the nicer the other students are because they don't know how to deliver criticism. Yeah. So they'll start saying things like, I loved the way you used the color purple in the fourth page. That was really moving.
Yeah. Forget the rest. But
You've got to be able to listen to the truth. And that's also something that serves you well as a grown-up novelist. When you read some soul-crushingly bad reviews that you just think, no, you know what? You didn't get it. And at the same time, you read some reviews that are praising you and you think, boy, you didn't get that either.
If you want concrete advice, Ann Patchett's on that front is do not borrow money to get an MFA, a Master of Fine Arts.
Yeah, boy. Can that be the take? Let's put marriage aside.
Don't go into debt for it.
The takeaway from this hour of On Point. Yeah. Don't go into debt for creative writing because this is not a medical degree. You are not going to earn back that enormous student loan that you took out, and it will crush you. And it will crush your writing, I think.
Ann Patchett's done all right, but beware that path. Drew in Charlotte, North Carolina. You're on with Ann.
Hey, Tom. Hey, Ann. How's it going?
Good.
Hi.
My girlfriend is a huge fan of yours, Ann. She's not going to believe that I'm talking to you. And not to be eclipsed, Tom, I'm a huge fan of yours, and I can't believe I'm talking to you either.
Oh, come on. What do you got? What do you got for us, Drew?
Well, I'm a dog trainer, and my girlfriend is a librarian, and we both love dogs, both love books. It's part of the ingredient of the glue that keeps us together. And I had a question for Anne. Why do you think dogs and books go so well together?
Because you can enjoy them. You can enjoy them on a quiet day at home, and they're always there for you. The dog, the book, emotionally, 100% of the time, they're always there for you. And there's a lot about dogs in this book. And I'm actually in a radio station in Nashville, a recording studio, with my dog, Sparky. And I think that the marriage of someone who loves dogs and someone who loves books, that sounds really well balanced. And I would also like to say that the sentence that a man is most likely to speak to me upon meeting me is, my girlfriend loves you, my wife loves you, or my mother loves you.
Hey, could be worse. Dog trainer and a librarian in Charlotte, the boyfriend and the girlfriend, and just the right mixture, maybe. Drew, you're right on Ann Patchett's wavelength there with Sparky and Rose before and all the rest. Our time is so short. I want to bring it back to your opening thought. We're looking at love and the writing life, and somehow there's maybe a common anchor there, which is work. Like, put in the work to make it come together. It seems to be your big theme here, Ann.
Creativity is a match. And I think that when I was 18, I was creative and I had a match. And now, a month shy of 50, I have lived my whole life in a warm house. The relationship between creativity or falling into passionate, crazy love is a match. And being 50 and living your whole life in a warm house is the ability to split wood. A match never kept anybody warm for 30 years. And if you're going to make it work, if it's writing, art, owning a bookstore, being a good friend, being in a marriage, make it work. It's the most satisfying, joy-producing work in the world.
Split the wood. Do the work.
Split the wood.
Ann Patchett's new collection is This is the Story of a Happy Marriage. She joined us from Nashville, Tennessee, where her bookstore is as well, Parnassus. And wonderful spending an hour with you. Thank you so much for all your insights.
Thank you.
Just great to have you. Ann Patchett, this is the story of a happy marriage. Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm at Tom Ashbrook, NPR on Twitter. Thanks for joining us today. This is On Point.